The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a species of beetle often found living in ant colonies has developed a cloaking system to go undetected, but it could represent an evolutionary dead end. And scientists believe the fossilized skeleton of a 2-pound dinosaur could offer new clues into dino evolution. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Several species of what are known as rove beetles make curious homes. The beetles live in ant colonies, and to go undetected by ants who would otherwise not appreciate an intruder, the beetles have a kind of cloaking device. But what makes them undetectable also keeps them from moving out. To learn more, I spoke with Joe Parker, an evolutionary biologist at the California Institute of Technology.
Rove beetles are not a trivial group of organisms. They're one of the most successful forms of life on Earth. There are 67,000 known species of rove beetles. That's maybe 5 to 10% of the total diversity globally. They're really tiny insects. Most of them are predators that live down in the dirt, in leaf litter and soil habitats. They're predatory organisms, and they look a bit different to typical beetles. If you think about a beetle, it's got these wing cases that cover the abdomen. Rove beetles have these wing cases, but they're kind of short and compact. And this leaves the segments of the abdomen exposed, and the abdomen is kind of elongate and flexible. And this enables rove beetles to snake through leaf litter and soil habitats, chasing down other invertebrates that they feed on. And what's really, really interesting, among other things, about rove beetles is because they've kind of sacrificed this physical protection of the body, it's transformed them into the chemists of the animal kingdom, because many different lineages have evolved chemical defense glands that secrete nasty compounds, which makes them kind of biochemically really, really interesting. And many of the interactions that they have with other organisms in the environment are mediated through chemical means, chemical communication.
So this particular species of rove beetle that you've studied in this paper has an interesting symbiotic relationship with a species of ant. And
yes,
we think of symbiotic relationships where one animal says, I'll scratch your back, and the other one says, okay, I'll scratch yours, and there's an exchange. What can you tell me about this situation and this beetle and this also particular species of ant?
Well, symbiosis is really a broader term that captures everything along the spectrum from mutualistic interactions where things are very equitable, both partners benefiting from the interaction, to one much more one-sided parasitic associations, like we think is happening in the case of this beetle. So it's a parasitic form of symbiosis and a very specific mode of parasitism called social parasitism, where the host organism that's being exploited is really the superorganismal colony of an ant. Now, that's another really interesting thing about rove beetles, is that many times during their evolutionary history, they've evolved the amazing ability to infiltrate ant societies and live as these socially parasitic impostors. And what we've done is taken one example of this that lives in California and really break open this form of symbiosis at a kind of cellular level to understand how these beetles are able to infiltrate the ant society. Now, if you were going to live inside an ant colony, the number one thing that you absolutely have to do is switch up your chemistry, because ants are interacting with members of their own colony and accepting them as nest mates, depending on chemicals on their bodies called cuticular hydrocarbons. These are kind of waxy pheromones. You'll see ants in a colony tapping each other with their antennae. They're detecting these chemicals on the bodies of their nest mates to determine if you are one of my sisters or not. And if you don't have the right chemicals on your body, ants are kind of innately aggressive towards intruders, right, which don't have the right chemical compounds on their bodies. Now, what this beetle has done is evolve the ability to perfectly mimic those cuticular hydrocarbons, this kind of chemical cocktail on the body, not by making the exact same compounds as the ant, but shutting off its own biosynthesis, its own production of these chemicals. So it's this stealth beetle, this blank canvas onto which it can then paint the ant's own cuticular hydrocarbons, and then it effectively bastes its own body down with the ant's pheromones. So now it is recognized by the ants as a nestmate, is assimilated into the social structure of the nest, is fed mouth to mouth by the ants, can get into the ants' brood galleries where the eggs and larvae are stored, and it will feed on those as this incredibly specialized ant predator, essentially, that is treated like royalty inside the nest. And there are other benefits to doing this as well. So there are very few parasites or predators inside the ant colony because it's this kind of very heavily guarded fortress. And so the beetle can, you know, really live the life in this kind of idyllic environment, as long as it's keeping the ants happy by pulling off this kind of deception. And so what it has to constantly do is climb up on top of ants and groom them to steal the pheromones to maintain this kind of chemical deception. But one of the key things that these chemicals on the body are also doing, both to ants and all other insects, is it's stopping the insect body from drying out. Insects lose water through the exoskeleton really, really quickly. So the other thing that these hydrocarbons, these waxy chemicals are doing, is acting as a barrier to desiccation. Now, if the beetle stops grooming ants, it will dry out really rapidly and die. And so this is one of the things that we think is locking it into what we call an obligate symbiosis, where it has no choice but to live inside the ant colony. You know, the payoff is really big. You know, you live in this kind of very resource-rich, climatically controlled, predator-free environment, but you can never leave, because to leave is to desiccate and die.
So in other words, the beetle sheds its own hydrocarbons that it creates. It enters the ant colony as this stealth beetle because it's exactly lost those chemicals that the ants can detect. Then it grooms the other ants, and then it can
directly
walk around.
Steals them. Yes.
And then it can walk around and hang out in the ant colony all of it wants to. But
yes,
because it shed its own hydrocarbons in the first place, it can't get them back, right? It's stuck depending on these ant hydrocarbons.
Exactly. The possibility of living freely outside the colony is gone for this beetle, because once it shuts off this pathway that manufactures these chemicals, we found it cannot turn them back on. And so you can think about this beetle being kind of caught in this evolutionary kind of catch-22 to integrate into the ant colony evolutionarily. Two things had to happen. It had to evolve this mechanism to silence its own pheromones so it could become stealth, and it had to evolve this behavior to reacquire those chemicals horizontally from the ant through this grooming behavior. So it had to evolve to be attracted to the ant, and its ancestors that inside the colony absolutely weren't. If they bump into an ant, they'd run in the opposite direction. Now, you can imagine how mutations in the beetle's DNA could like revert either one of those traits, like damage the trait, cause it to revert back to the kind of ancestral condition that its free living ancestors used to have. So for example, if a mutation randomly turned up that caused the beetle to unsilence its cuticular hydrocarbons, right? So it started to produce them again, its cover would be blown. It would be detected by the ants and it would be killed because it would still be attracted to them. Conversely, simultaneously, if a mutation arose that stopped the beetle being attracted to ants, so it would no longer climb up on top of them and groom them, well, there'd be nothing to keep it inside the colony. It would wander outside of the nest. Because it had the cuticular hydrocarbon silencing mechanism, it would desiccate and die. And so you'd have to simultaneously mutate both of these traits in the beetle all at once to create a beetle that could ever live outside of the colony again. And that's a very, very low probability event of that ever happening. And in fact, what you see across the evolutionary tree of these beetles, these rove beetles, is that when they evolve this form of symbiosis that this beetle Skeptobius kind of is emblematic of, and there are many evolutionary replica kind of lineages like this across the tree of these beetles. Once they evolve this way of life, they never ever revert to being free living again. So you never see lineages get regaining the chance of living outside of the ant colony.
So it's like a evolutionary dead end, if you will.
It's kind of an evolutionary dead end. Once you evolve it, there's no going back. But what we've also found is that the beetle is what we call quite promiscuous. And by when we say that, what we mean is that the beetle, yes, it lives in colonies of just this one ant species in nature, and maybe it would just end up going extinct with its host. If the ant actually succumbed to extinction, the beetle would go with it. But what we found experimentally is when you place this beetle with a large diversity of different ant species, it's very willing to accept them as hosts. It will climb up on top of them. It will groom them. It can take their cuticular hydrocarbon profiles, and it can assimilate into the colonies of many different ant species. So even though in nature this beetle is associated with just one ant host, it has this latent ability to interact and forge relationships, forge symbioses with a much greater diversity of species. Now, across the tree of life, where you see obligate symbiosis evolve, often these organisms are very, very kind of entrenched in the biology of just a single host species. But if you zoom out across their evolutionary trees, you often see them jumping to evolutionarily distant host species. This phenomenon called host switching. And so what we see in this beetle is that, yes, its kind of ecology, its symbiosis is entrenched, it is irreversible, but whether or not it's an evolutionary dead end is a bit more of an open question, because it does have this chance to sidestep, to dodge undergoing co-extinction with this host if it takes up an association with a different ant species over evolutionary time, like many symbiotic lineages seem to have the ability to do.
Ants have so many different roles in an ecosystem, and they recycle nutrients and they move things around and they aerate the earth with their nests. They do so many different things. What does the beetle do other than mooch off of the ants?
Yes, ants are absolutely keystone organisms within ecosystems. They are interacting with thousands of different species in the environment. The species that is the host ant to this beetle is forming colonies of millions of workers that fan out across the forest floor and are foraging and interacting with many different organisms, affecting soil properties, influencing rates of plant growth. They are really ecosystem engineers and are kind of a dominant species within this ecosystem. But here we have this beetle that's really capitalized on the resources that the ants are concentrating inside their colonies. And these beetles can reach relatively high frequencies in any single ant colony. And so you have to think that one of the things that may be keeping the ant population itself in check is the presence of this imposter beetle, which can sneak in there, can grow its population and exist as this parasitic kind of burden inside the ant colonies.
Is that because the beetle is just getting in the way, or it's eating the ants' food?
Yeah, I think by preying on the brood, by siphoning off some of the food inside colonies, as ants feed each other and the beetle is tapping into that kind of social flow of nutrients inside the colonies, its population is growing and is probably one of the kind of constraints on the expansion of the ant population.
Well, Joe, where will your research take you next? And are you going to continue diving into the world of the rove beetle?
I've studied rove beetles since I was a teenager. I just find these insects so fascinating. They have so much to tell us about the evolution of the biosphere in general. There are so many mysteries about how ecological relationships between species originate and become so specialized and become entrenched. And these beetles are a kind of tractable model system that illuminates these much more general questions about how life on Earth originated. And we in my lab are interested in studying every dimension of their biology, from their ecology and their behavior down to how they function at a kind of cellular and neurobiological level, to create a really integrated picture of how new kinds of species interaction emerge in the natural world. So there's still everything to study about these beetles.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me about it. I appreciate it.
That's great. Thank you.
Joe Parker is an evolutionary biologist at the California Institute of Technology. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. For more than a decade, scientists have been studying the fossilized skeleton of a tiny dinosaur found in modern-day Argentina. And according to Peter McAvicky, a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, the specimen is kind of like a Rosetta Stone for the group of bird-like dinosaurs called Alnischetri. I spoke with him to learn more.
What we discovered with my colleagues in Argentina is a very complete skeleton of what is one of the smallest dinosaurs yet discovered in South America. It's an animal called Alnischetri serrapoliciensis. It's quite a mouthful. But this is, despite the long name, a very small dinosaur, as I mentioned. I think if you pictured a dinosaur version of a roadrunner, that would be a pretty apt description. So a small, very fleet animal with very long hind limbs, a fairly long tail, specializing on small prey, you know, invertebrates, little vertebrates, lizards, things like that. That's the kind of animal we're looking at.
And feathers, too. I mean, I think that's worth pointing out that a lot of times we think of dinosaurs as smooth or bumbly skin, like in the movies. But as I understand it, this dinosaur had feathers.
Yeah. So where we found Alnischetri, we don't actually, this site doesn't preserve the exterior or the skin of the animal. But based on its relationship to other similar dinosaurs that have been found with feathers, we can fairly safely infer that it had a plumage, much like a bird.
So this is an animal that lived 90 million years ago. And as I understand, before somewhat recently, we didn't have such a complete look at the fossilized skeleton of this dinosaur. But all of that changed with the discovery in Patagonia. What can you tell me about the skeleton that was discovered in South America?
Yeah, so the place that we found it is called La Butrera, which is Spanish for the vulture roost, mainly because it's a series of canyons where vultures like to hang out on the cliff edges and nest. But it's a fairly unique site geologically because it likes to preserve very small creatures. So nearby and elsewhere in South America, there's an abundance of really big dinosaur bones, but we actually have very few places where we find the small members of the ecosystems and community. So this is one of those exceptions. Alnischetri belongs to a rather weird group of meat-eating dinosaurs called alvarosaurs. They've been found in South America before, but never very complete and never with a skull. So we actually found the most complete alvarosaur yet discovered from South America, and this one thankfully has a skull. So that allows us to do a lot of detailed anatomical work, kind of figure out how these things are related to one another, but also make some interesting inferences about the ecology of these animals, what they ate, what they might have been looked like, and how they fit into their ecosystems.
What was the dinosaur world like? What was Earth like at this time? And how does this dinosaur fit into the sort of greater dinosaur ecosystem?
90 million years ago, the Earth was a very warm and a very wet place, by and large. A lot of the continental interiors were covered by seaway because sea levels were very high. That certainly includes much of North America, where we had a seaway running from the Gulf of Mexico in the south to the Arctic Ocean in the north. But there were still dry places, of course, and one of those dry places is actually where we find Alnischeutri and other small animals at La Boutera. So they're preserved in sand dunes that were at the edge of a large desert. So if you picture something like the southwestern U.S. or maybe the Sahara with bigger dune fields, that's kind of what we're talking about in that part of the world. And as with deserts today, back then you would have had animals that specialized for living in those dry, hostile types of environments. So we do find a unique fauna in this part of South America at this time. And it includes very small dinosaurs. Alnischeutri is the smallest, but we have other small predators and plant eaters that none of which exceed about 20 or 25 pounds in body size. They lived alongside snakes, little primitive snakes that still had legs. These large lizard-like sphenodontians that were probably the main herbivores in this weird desert environment. Some small mammals. And then farther afield, we do find in rocks of about the same age, very large dinosaurs. So some of the biggest dinosaurs we know, like Argentinosaurus, a long-necked sauropod, Giganotosaurus, big predator, those would have been part of that ecosystem as well. So this was a very rich ecosystem with a bunch of small animals and also some really truly gigantic ones around, you know, in excess of 30 or 50 tons.
I guess what fascinates me is that by looking at the skeletons and the fossils of these dinosaurs and inferring about what these ecosystems looked like, you can sort of make comparisons to how an ecosystem functions tens of millions of years later. So a small dinosaur would have eaten small creatures, ants and termites, and I'm thinking of anteaters and other creatures that are able to tear apart logs and termite mounds. So is that also something that's fascinating to you, is to imagine how these animals might have adapted to live in an ecosystem in a different way, but similar to an entirely different animal millions of years later?
One of the sort of 10 or 20,000 foot view goals of doing this kind of evolutionary and paleontological research is to try and identify, you know, broader commonalities that kind of explain or help us understand how evolution has shaped ecosystems and how ecosystems have some general rules that sort of, you know, apply whether we're in the modern or we go back 90 million years. One of the interesting things that we sort of inferred from this study by comparing Alnischeutri to all these other alvarosaurs is that they're interesting because, unlike most other dinosaur groups, they never get very big. They have a number of different lineages, and Alnischeutri is one of them, that do the opposite. They actually get smaller over evolutionary time. But the biggest alvarosaurs, you know, the giants, as it were, among the group, are only about the size of an average human. Most of them are smaller, and some of them are among the smallest non-bird dinosaurs that we know. And this sort of stands in contrast to what we see other groups of dinosaurs. You know, a lot of them start small-ish or medium size and then get big over time, like tyrannosaurs, or the big sauropods, or horned dinosaurs. Why are the alvarosaurs so different? And one of the possible explanations for that is, again, that they might actually have been specialized insectivorous or ant-eating species And if we look at modern ecosystems, the biggest ant-eating animals out there are things like the giant anteater of South America or the aardvark of Africa. And those animals never get over 100 pounds in body size. So, there seems to be maybe some ecological rules about being an anteater that apply today, but would also apply to ant-eating animals 90 million years ago.
Now that we have this well-preserved, nearly complete skeleton, what else is there to discover about this animal, and what else are you excited to dig into?
Yeah, so we're going in a couple of directions. One of these is to sort of dive even deeper into the anatomy and the understanding of this animal. So it's recently been put in a CT scanner. And so we are diving into some of the sort of really fine scale anatomical details to try and understand the biology of this animal. For example, looking into its sensory capacity as revealed by the dimensions of its inner ear spaces and its brain. And then the other direction we're going is sort of, again, probing this question of, okay, so if body size and ecology are not intimately related, what is the story behind the special sort of anatomy of alvarosaurs and also their sort of restricted body size range? And in that sense, we got very lucky. What's actually driving that is yet another discovery from Labutrera from about right between where we have our two specimens of Alnus Schoettri. We found another alvarosaur that has shorter arms, smaller teeth, but is a lot bigger than Alnus Schoettri. So it's going to kind of fill in some of those questions that, arose because we discovered Alnus Schoettri. We can now help answer those with the new discovery. So that's happening right now. The specimen is in Argentina being prepared, so taken out of the rock, and we hope to study it soon.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Lucas.
Peter Makovicky is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. His research is published in the journal Nature. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1852. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.